to the thoughts that are matched to exactly the same feeling. As a result, those thoughts that you unconsciously think about are the ones you accept, believe, and surrender to over and over. Conversely, it could also be said that you're much less suggestible to any thoughts that are not equal to your memorized feelings. Any new thought that reflects an unknown possibility just wouldn't feel right. Your self-talk, the thoughts that you listen to every day, slips by your conscious awareness on a moment-to-moment basis and stimulates the autonomic nervous system and the flow of biological processes, reinforcing the programmed feeling of who you think you are. Remember the study in Chapter 2, where researchers found that optimists responded more favorably to suggestions that were positive, while pessimists responded more unfavorably to suggestions that were negative. By the same means, if you were to change how you feel, could you become more suggestible to a new stream of thoughts? Absolutely. By feeling an elevated emotion and allowing a whole new set of thoughts to be driven by that new feeling, you'd increase your level of suggestibility to what you were feeling and then thinking. You'd be in a new state of being, and your new thoughts would then be the auto-suggestions equal to that feeling. And when you feel emotions, you're naturally activating your implicit memory system and the autonomic nervous system. You can simply allow the autonomic nervous system to do what it does best: restore balance, health, and order. Isn't that what many people did in the placebo studies mentioned earlier? Weren't they able to bring up an elevated emotion like hope, or inspiration, or the joy of being well? And once they saw a new possibility without ever analyzing it, wasn't their level of suggestibility influenced by those feelings? As they felt those corresponding emotions, didn't they enter the operating system and reprogram their autonomic nervous system with new orders? By thought alone, auto-suggesting equal to those emotions. If there are different degrees of suggestibility, then that can be demonstrated visually by showing different thicknesses of the analytical mind. The thicker the barrier between the conscious mind and the subconscious mind, the more difficulty you'll have getting into the operating system. Take a look at figures 6.6 and 6.7 on the following two pages, which represent two people with different types of minds. The person in figure 6.6 has a very thin veil between the conscious and subconscious minds, and therefore is very open to suggestion. Like Ivan Santiago from the beginning of the chapter, this person will naturally accept, believe, and surrender to an outcome because he or she doesn't analyze or intellectualize too much. Folks like this might be more innately prone to accept that a thought is a potential experience and embrace it emotionally so that the package becomes imprinted on the autonomic nervous system, ready to be executed as a reality. These people don't spend a lot of time trying to figure things out in their lives, and they don't overthink many things. If you've ever seen a hypnosis stage show, the subjects who make it to the front of the room usually fall into this category. Now contrast this with figure 6.7. If you look at the thicker analytical mind that separates the conscious and subconscious minds, you can easily see that this person is less prone to taking suggestions at face value without a significant degree of help from his or her intellectual mind in evaluating, processing, planning, and reviewing. People like this are highly critical and will make sure they've analyzed everything before simply surrendering and trusting. Bear in mind that some of us have a more built-up analytical mind even without constantly living by our stress hormones. We might have studied different subjects in college or lived with parents who reinforced the mechanisms of rational thought when we were young, or maybe it was just part of our nature. Nevertheless, you can have a significantly broad, analytical mind and still learn how to get beyond it. I certainly did. So, there's hope. As I said before, neither of these types is more advantageous than the other. I think a healthy balance between the two works very well. Someone who's over-analytical is less likely to trust and flow in his life or her life. Someone who's overly suggestible might be too gullible and less functional. The point I want to make is that if you're continually analyzing your life, judging yourself, and obsessing about everything in your reality, then you'll never enter the operating system where those old programs exist and reprogram them. Only when a person accepts, believes, and surrenders to a suggestion does the door between the conscious and subconscious minds open. That information then signals the autonomic nervous system and, presto, it takes over. Now take a look at figure 6.8. The arrow represents the movement of consciousness from the conscious mind into the subconscious mind, where the suggestion is biologically embossed into the programming system. A few additional elements can also silence the analytical mind and open the door to the subconscious mind in order to increase a person's level of suggestibility. For example, physical or mental fatigue increases your suggestibility. Certain studies have shown that the limited exposure to social, physical, and environmental cues in sensory deprivation can cause increased susceptibility. Extreme hunger, emotional shock, and trauma also weaken our analytical faculties, therefore making us more suggestible to information. Like hypnosis, meditation is another way to bypass the critical mind and move into the subconscious system of programs. The whole purpose of meditation is to move your awareness beyond your analytical mind, to take your attention off your outer world, your body and time, and to pay attention to your inner world of thoughts and feelings. Many stigmas surround the word meditation. Most people conjure up images of a bearded guru on a mountaintop, immune to the elements and sitting in perfect stillness, a monk in a simple robe, his face adorned with a huge, mysterious smile, or even a young and beautiful woman with flawless skin, on the cover of a magazine dressed in stylish yoga clothes and looking serenely free from the enslavement of all of the demands of daily life. When we see these images, many of us might perceive the discipline required is too impractical, too out of reach and beyond our abilities. We might see meditation as a spiritual practice that doesn't fit into our religious beliefs. And some of us are simply overwhelmed with the seemingly endless variations of meditation available and are unable to decide where to begin. But it doesn't have to be that difficult out there or confusing. For this discussion, let's just say that the whole purpose of meditation is to move our consciousness beyond the analytical mind and into deeper levels of consciousness. In meditation, we move not just from the conscious mind to the subconscious mind, but also from the selfish to selfless, from being somebody and someone to being nobody and no one. From being a materialist to being an immaterialist. From being someplace to being no place. From being in time to being in no time. From believing that the outer world is reality and defining reality with our senses, to believing that the inner world is reality, and that once there we enter non-sense, the world of thought beyond the senses. Meditation takes us from survival to creation, from separation to connection, from imbalance to balance, from emergency mode to growth and repair mode, and from the limiting emotions of fear, anger, and sadness to the expansive emotions of joy, freedom, and love. Basically, we go from clinging to the known to embracing the unknown. Let's reason this for a moment. If your neocortex is the home of your conscious awareness, and it's where you construct thoughts, use analytical reasoning, exercise intellect, and demonstrate rational processes, then you'll have to move your consciousness beyond, or out of, your neocortex in order to meditate. Your consciousness would have to essentially move from your thinking brain into your limbic brain and the subconscious regions. In other words, in order for you to dial down your neocortex and all the neural activity that it performs on a daily basis, you'd have to stop thinking analytically and vacate the faculties of reason, logic, intellectualizing, forecasting, predicting, and rationalizing, at least temporarily. This is what's meant by quieting your mind. Revisit figure 6.1 if you need to. According to the neuroscientific model that I outlined in the previous chapters, to quiet your mind would mean that you'd have to declare a ceasefire on all of the automatic neural networks in your thinking brain that you habitually fire on a regular basis. That is, you'd have to stop reminding yourself of who you think you are, repeatedly reproducing the same level of mind. I know that sounds like a huge task that may well be overwhelming, but it turns out that practical, scientifically proven ways exist for us to accomplish this feat and make it a skill. In the workshops that I teach around the world, many ordinary people who'd never meditated before got pretty good at doing this, once they'd learned how. You'll learn these methods in the chapters that follow, but first, let's increase your level of intention so that when you get to the how-to, you'll reap greater rewards, just as did the aerobic exercisers in Quebec from Chapter 2, who were told that their well-being would be enhanced by their efforts and thus could assign meaning to what they were doing, and then got better results. The analytical neocortex uses all of the five senses to determine reality. It's very preoccupied with putting all of its awareness on the body, the environment, and time. And if you're the least bit stressed, then your attention will be directed to and will amplify all three of these elements. When you're under the gun of the fight-or-flight emergency system and you switch on your adrenaline, just like any animal threatened in the wild, all of your attention will be placed on taking care of your body, finding escape routes in your environment, and figuring out how much time you have to make it to safety. You overfocus on problems, obsess about your looks, dwell on your pain, think about how little time you have to do what you need to do, and rush to get things done. Sound familiar? Because you're so hyper-focused on this external world and your problems in it when you're living in survival, it's easy to think that what you see and experience is all there is. And without the external world, you're no one, no body, no thing, and in no place. How frightful that is for an ego that's trying to control all its reality by constantly reaffirming an identity. It might make it easier if you remind yourself that when you're living in survival, what you sense is truly just the tip of the iceberg, only a limited array of ingredients making up your external world. You identify with the many variations and combinations in your external world that reflect back to you who you think you are, but that doesn't mean there isn't more. In fact, every time you learn something new, you change how you see the world. The world hasn't really changed. Only your perception of it has changed. We'll learn more about perception in the next chapter. For now, it's enough to keep in mind that if your goal is to affect change, and you haven't been able to make it happen with all your external world resources, then clearly you'll need to look outside the limits of what you see, sense, and experience for your answers. You'll need to pull from other sources you haven't yet identified, from the unknown. So in that sense, the unknown is your friend, not your foe. It's the place where the answer lies. Another reason it becomes difficult for us to pull our attention away from all the conditions of our outer world and place our attention on our inner world is that most people are addicted to stress hormones, to feeling the rush of chemicals that are the result of our conscious or unconscious reactions. This addiction reinforces our belief that our outer world is more real than our inner world. And our physiology is conditioned to support this, because real threats, problems, and concerns do exist that need our attention. So we become addicted to our present external environment. And through associative memory, we use the problems and conditions in our lives to reaffirm that emotional addiction in order to remember who we think we are. Here's another way to say it. The stress hormones we experience while living in survival mode give the body a high dose of energy and cause the five senses, which plug us into external reality, to become heightened. So naturally, if we're continuously stressed, we'll define reality with our senses. We become materialists. When we try to go within and connect with the world of non-sense and the immaterial, it takes some effort to break our conditioned habit and our addiction to the chemical rush we get from our external reality. How, then, could we possibly believe that thought is more powerful than physical, three-dimensional reality? If that's how we see things, it becomes challenging to change anything by thought alone, because we've become enslaved to our bodies and our environments. Maybe one antidote to that is rereading the stories in Chapter 1, and reading the stories from my workshops later in Chapters 9 and 10. Reinforcing new information that shows us that what we think should be impossible is indeed possible helps us remind ourselves that there's more to reality than what our senses perceive. Whether we want to admit it or not, we are the placebo. If meditation is about entering the autonomic nervous system so that we can become more suggestible and overcome the challenges just mentioned, then we need to know how to get there. The short answer is that we get there on a brainwave. The brain state we happen to be in at any given time has a huge effect on how suggestible we are at that moment. Once you learn what these different states are and how to recognize them when you're in them, you can train yourself to move from one state to another, up and down the scale of brainwave patterns. It takes some practice, of course, but it's possible. So let's explore these different states to learn more about them. When neurons fire together, they exchange charged elements that then produce electromagnetic fields. And these fields are what are measured during a brain scan, like an electroencephalograph, or EEG. Humans have several measurable brainwave frequencies. And the slower the brainwave state we're in, the deeper we go into the inner world of the subconscious mind. In order of slowest to fastest, the brainwave states are delta, deep, restorative sleep, totally unconscious, theta, a twilight state between deep sleep and wakefulness, alpha, the creative, imaginative state, beta, conscious thought, and gamma, elevated states of consciousness. Beta is our everyday waking state. When we're in beta, the thinking brain, or neocortex, is processing all of the incoming sensory data and creating meaning between our outer and inner worlds. Beta isn't the best state for meditation because when we're in beta, the outer world appears more real than the inner world. Three levels of brainwave patterns make up the beta wave spectrum. Low-range beta, relaxed, interested attention, like reading a book. Mid-range beta, focused attention on an ongoing stimulus outside the body, like learning and then remembering. And high-range beta, highly focused, crisis mode attention, when stress chemicals are produced. The higher the beta brainwaves, the further away we get from being able to access the operating system. Most days we move back and forth between beta and alpha states. Alpha is our relaxation state, where we pay less attention to the outer world and start to pay more attention to our inner world. When we're in alpha, we're in a light state of meditation. You could also call that imagination or daydreaming. In this state, our inner world is more real than our outer world, because that's what we're paying attention to. When we go from high-frequency beta to slower alpha, where we can pay attention, concentrate, and focus in a more relaxed manner, we automatically activate the frontal lobe. As the previous material has presented, the frontal lobe lowers the volume on the brain circuits that process time and space. Hence, we're no longer in survival mode. We're in a more creative state that makes us more suggestible than we were in beta. More challenging is learning how to drop down even further into theta, which is a kind of twilight state where we're half awake and half asleep. Often described as mind awake, body asleep. This is the state we're shooting for in meditation because it's the brainwave pattern where we're the most suggestible. In theta, we can access the subconscious because the analytical mind isn't operating. We're mostly in our inner world. Think of theta as the key to your own subconscious kingdom. Take another look at figure 6.8. It shows brainwave states and how they correlate with the conscious and subconscious mind. Then take a look at figure 6.9, which illustrates the different brainwave frequencies. You'll find this brief tour through brainwave patterns even more useful when you get to the practice of meditation later in the book. Don't expect that you'll necessarily be able to drop right into theta on command, of course, but having some knowledge of what the various brain states are and what effect they have on what you're trying to achieve will help. Now let's return to the story of Ivan Santiago and the other hypnosis subjects from the start of this chapter. Obviously, these folks have an easier time getting past their analytical minds than most of us. They seem to have both a neuroplasticity and an emotional plasticity that allow them to make their inner worlds more real than their outer worlds. In their normal waking states, they probably spend more time in alpha than in beta. So they have fewer stress hormones circulating that can pull them out of homeostasis. Their highly suggestible states better enable their conscious minds to control the autonomic functions of their subconscious minds. Yet they're not all the same. Several different degrees of suggestibility were demonstrated in this study. The 16 people who passed the initial evaluation were certainly suggestible, although they weren't all as suggestible as those who passed the next test by taking their clothes off in public after being given a post-hypnotic suggestion to do so, going against deeply rooted social norms. The four who passed that test were certainly highly suggestible, able to be greater than their social environment. But when it came to immersing themselves in the ice water, three of those four couldn't go that far. They weren't able to be greater than their physical environment. Only Santiago, who remained greater than his physical environment in extreme conditions for an extended period of time, while having dominion over his body, demonstrated the highest level of suggestibility. He was able not only to withstand the frigid ice bath, but also to be greater than his moral environment by following the post-hypnotic suggestion to shoot the foreign dignitary, despite the fact that his conscious personality was hardly one of a cold-blooded killer. In terms of the placebo effect, it takes a similar high degree of suggestibility to be greater than the body and greater than the environment for an extended period of time. That is, to accept, believe, and surrender to the idea of your inner world being more real than your outer world. But in just a few chapters, you'll learn how you can not only change your beliefs and become more suggestible, but also use that state to program your subconscious mind, not to shoot a stuntman with a prop gun, fortunately, but to triumph over whatever health issues, emotional traumas, or other personal matters you may be dealing with.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
The New York Times best-selling book, You Are the Placebo, Making Your Mind Matter, by Dr. Joe Dispenza. Read by Adam Boyce. Copyright 2014 by Dr. Joe Dispenza. For my mother, Francesca. Chapter 7. Attitudes, Beliefs, and Perceptions. A 12-year-old Indonesian boy with a vacant stare opens his mouth to willingly accept shards of broken glass from people in a crowd gathered in Jakarta Park to watch traditional Javanese trance dancing called kudalumping. The boy chews on the glass and swallows it as if it were nothing more than a handful of popcorn or pretzels, and he shows no ill effects. As a third-generation kudalumper, this youth has been ingesting glass in similar mystical performances since he was 9. The boy and the other 19 members of his traditional dance troupe recite a Javanese spell before every performance, summoning the spirits of the dead to reside in one of them for the duration of that day's dance, protecting that dancer from pain. The boy and his fellow dancers are no different in certain respects from the Appalachian snake-handling preachers described in Chapter 1, who become anointed with the spirit and enthusiastically dance around the pulpit with venomous snakes coiled around their arms and shoulders. Bringing them dangerously close to their faces, they are seemingly immune to the venom if bitten. The dancers are also similar to the Fijian firewalkers from the Suwayu tribe on the island of Bikwa, who unflinchingly walk across white-hot stones that have been covered in flaming logs and glowing red coals for hours, an ability said to have been given to one of the tribe's ancestors by a god and then passed down within the tribe. The glass-eating boy, the snake-handling preacher, and the Fijian firewalker never pause even for a moment to think, "I wonder if it will work this time." There isn't an ounce of wishy-washiness in any of them. The decision to chew glass or handle copperheads or tread on searing stones transcends their bodies, the environment and time, altering their biology to allow them to do the seemingly impossible. Their rock-solid belief in the protection of their gods leaves no room for second-guessing. The placebo effect is similar in that very strong beliefs are part of the equation. Yet this component hasn't been examined much, because up to this point in mind-body research, most scientific studies have measured only the effects of the placebo instead of looking for the cause. Whether the shift in one's internal state has been the product of faith healing, conditioning, the release of suppressed emotions, a belief in symbols, or a specific spiritual practice, the question still remains. What has happened to create such profound alterations in the body? And if we discover what that is, can we cultivate it? Our beliefs aren't always as conscious as we think they are. We may very well accept an idea on the surface, but if deep down we don't really believe it's possible, then our acceptance is just an intellectual process. Because calling upon the placebo effect requires us to truly change our beliefs about ourselves and what's possible for our bodies and our health, we need to understand what beliefs are and where they come from. Let's suppose a person goes to the doctor with certain symptoms and is diagnosed with a condition based on the physician's objective findings. The doctor gives the patient a diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment options based on the average outcome. The moment that the person hears the doctor say, diabetes, cancer, hypothyroidism, or chronic fatigue syndrome, a series of thoughts, images, and emotions is conjured up based on his or her past experience. That experience could be that the patient's parents had the condition, that he or she saw a show on TV in which one of the characters died of that disease, or even that something the person read on the internet scared him or her about the diagnosis. Once the patient sees the doctor and hears a professional opinion, the patient automatically accepts the condition, then believes what the confident doctor has said, and finally surrenders to the treatment and possible outcomes. And this is done without any real analysis. The patient is suggestible and susceptible to what the doctor says. If the person then embraces the emotions of fear, worry, and anxiety, along with sadness, then the only possible thoughts or auto-suggestions are those that are equal to how he or she feels. The patient can try to have positive thoughts about beating the disease, but his or her body still feels bad because the wrong placebo has been given, resulting in the wrong state of being, the signaling of the same genes, and the inability to see or perceive any new possibilities. The patient is pretty much at the mercy of his or her beliefs, and the beliefs of the doctor about the diagnosis. So when people like the folks you'll read about in the next few chapters healed themselves by using the placebo effect, what did they do differently? First, they didn't accept the finality of their diagnosis, prognosis, or treatment. Nor did they believe in the most probable outcome or future destiny that their doctors had authoritatively outlined. Finally, they didn't surrender to the diagnosis, prognosis, or suggested treatment. Because they had a different attitude from those who did accept, believe, and surrender, they were in a different state of being. They weren't suggestible to the doctor's advice and opinions because they didn't feel fearful, victimized, or sad. Instead, they were optimistic and enthusiastic, and those emotions drove a new set of thoughts, which enabled them to see new possibilities. Because they had different ideas and beliefs about what was possible, they didn't condition their bodies to the worst-case scenario. They didn't expect the same predictable outcome as others who'd received the same diagnosis. And they didn't assign the same meaning to the diagnosis as everyone else with the same condition. They assigned a different meaning to their future, so they had a different intention. They understood epigenetics and neuroplasticity, so instead of passively seeing themselves as victims of the disease, they used that knowledge to become proactive, fueled by what they'd learned in my workshops and events. As a result, these folks also got different and better results than other people who'd received the same diagnosis. just as the hotel maids got better results after the researchers gave them more information. Now think about the average person who receives a diagnosis and promptly announces, "I'm going to beat this." Someone may not accept the condition and the outcome the doctor outlines. But the difference is that most people haven't truly changed their beliefs about not being sick. Changing a belief requires changing a subconscious program. Since a belief, as you'll soon learn, is a subconscious state of being. Folks who only use their conscious minds to change never come out of the resting state to reprogram their genes, because they don't know how to do that. This is where their healing stops. They're unable to surrender to possibility, because they're not truly able to become suggestible to anything different from what the doctor tells them. Is it possible that whenever people don't respond to treatment, or when their health stays the same, they're living by the same emotional state every day, accepting, believing, and surrendering to the medical model without too much analysis, based on the social consciousness of millions of other people who've done exactly the same thing? Does a doctor's diagnosis become the modern-day equivalent of a voodoo curse? So now let's dissect belief a little further, backing up just slightly to begin with the following idea. When you string a succession of thoughts and feelings together so that they ultimately become habituated or automatic, they form an attitude. And since how you think and feel creates a state of being, attitudes are really just shortened states of being. They can fluctuate from moment to moment as you alter how you think and feel. Any particular attitude can last for minutes, hours, days, or even a week or two. For example, if you have a series of good thoughts that are aligned with a series of good feelings, you might say, "I have a good attitude today." And if you have a sequence of negative thoughts that's connected to a sequence of negative feelings, then you might say, "I have a bad attitude today." If you revisit the same attitude enough times, then it becomes automatic. If you repeat or maintain certain attitudes long enough, and you string those attitudes together, that's how you create a belief. A belief is just an extended state of being. Essentially, beliefs are thoughts and feelings, attitudes, that you keep thinking and feeling over and over again, until you hardwire them in your brain and emotionally condition them into your body. You could say that you become addicted to them, which is why it's so hard to change them, and why it doesn't feel good on a gut level when they're challenged. Because experiences are neurologically etched into your brain, causing you to think, and chemically embodied as emotions, causing you to feel, most of your beliefs are based on past memories. So when you revisit the same thoughts over and over by thinking about and analyzing what you remember from your past, these thoughts will fire and wire into an automatic, unconscious program. And if you cultivate the same feelings based on past experiences, and you feel the same as you did when the event originally occurred, you'll condition your body to subconsciously be the mind of that emotion. And your body will unconsciously be living in the past. And if the redundancy of how you think and feel over time conditions your body to become the mind, and it becomes programmed subconsciously, then beliefs are subconscious and also unconscious states of being derived from the past. Beliefs are also more permanent than attitudes. They can last for months or even years. And because they last longer, they become more programmed within you. Case in point is a story from my childhood that's stamped in my memory. I grew up in an Italian family, and when I was going into fourth grade, we moved to another city that had a mixture of both Italian and Jewish residents. On my first day of school that year, the teacher assigned me to a seat in a group of 6 desks, along with 3 Jewish girls. That was the day the girls broke the news to me that Jesus wasn't Italian. It was one of the most memorable days of my life. When I came home that afternoon, my little Italian mother kept asking me how my first day of school went, and I wouldn't talk to her. After I ignored her enough times, she finally grabbed me by the arm and insisted I tell her what was wrong. "I thought Jesus was Italian," I blurted out angrily. "What are you talking about?" she responded. "He's Jewish." "Jewish?" I shot back. "What do you mean? He looks Italian in all those pictures, doesn't he? Grandma talks in Italian to him all day long. And what's the deal with the Roman Empire? Isn't Rome in Italy?" So the belief that I had, that Jesus was Italian, was based on my past experiences, and how I thought and felt about Jesus had become my automatic state of being. This belief took some getting over, because changing deep-seated beliefs isn't easy. Needless to say, I succeeded. Now let's move the concept forward a little further. If you string a group of related beliefs together, they form your perception. So your perception of reality is a sustained state of being that's based on your long-standing beliefs, attitudes, thoughts and feelings. And since your beliefs become subconscious and also unconscious states of being, that is, you don't even know why you believe certain things, or you aren't really conscious of your beliefs until they're tested, your perceptions, how you subjectively see things, for the most part become your subconscious and unconscious view of your reality from the past. In fact, scientific experiments have shown that you don't see reality as it truly is. Instead, you unconsciously fill in your reality based on your memories of the past, which is what's neurochemically maintained in your brain. When perceptions become implicit or non-declarative, as was discussed in the last chapter, they become automatic or subconscious, so that you automatically edit reality subjectively. For example, you know your car is your car because you've driven it so many times. You have the same experience of your car daily because nothing much changes about it. You think and feel the same way about it most every day. Your attitude about your car has created a belief about it, which has formed a particular perception about your vehicle, that it's a good car, say because it rarely breaks down. And although you automatically accept that perception, it's actually a subjective perception, because someone else may have the same make and model of car as you do, and that person's car may break down all the time, causing him or her to have a different belief and different perceptions about the same vehicle, based on personal experience. In fact, if you're like most people, you probably don't pay attention to several aspects of your car unless something goes wrong. You expect it to run as it did the day before. You naturally expect your future experience of driving your car to be like your past experience, yesterday and the day before. That's your perception. But when it malfunctions, you have to pay more attention to it, like listening to the sound of the motor more closely, and become conscious of your unconscious perception of your car. Once your perception of your car is altered because something has changed about the way it drives, you'll now perceive your car differently. The same is true of relationships with your spouse and your co-workers, your culture and your race, and even your body and your pain. Actually, this is the way most perceptions about reality function. Now, if you want to change an implicit or subconscious perception, you must become more conscious and less unconscious. In truth, you'd have to increase your level of attention to all of the aspects of yourself and your life that you've previously stopped paying much attention to. Better yet, you'd have to wake up, change your level of awareness, and become conscious of what you were once unconscious about. But it's rarely that easy, because if you experience the same reality over and over again, then the way you think and feel about your current world will continue to develop into the same attitudes, which will inspire the same beliefs, which will expand into the same perceptions, as shown in Figure 7.1. When your perception becomes so second nature and so automatic that you really don't pay attention to the way reality truly is, because you automatically expect everything to be the same, you're now unconsciously accepting and agreeing to that reality. The way most people unconsciously accept and agree to what the medical model tells them about a diagnosis. So the only way to change your beliefs and perceptions in order to create a placebo response is to change your state of being. You have to finally see your old, limited beliefs for what they are, records of the past, and be willing to let go of them so that you can embrace new beliefs about yourself that will help you create a new future. So then ask yourself, what beliefs and perceptions about you and your life have you been unconsciously agreeing to that you'd have to change in order to create this new state of being? This is a question that requires some thought, because, as I said, with many of these beliefs, we aren't even aware that we believe them. Often we accept certain cues from our environment that then prime us to accept certain beliefs, which may or may not be true. Either way, the moment we accept the belief, it has an effect not only on our performance, but also on the choices we make. Remember the study from Chapter 2 about the women taking the math test, who first read fake research reports about men being better than women in math. Those who'd read that the advantage was due to genetics scored lower than those who read that the advantage was due to stereotyping. Although both reports were false, men are no better at math than women, the women in the group who'd read that they had a genetic disadvantage believed what they'd read and then scored lower. It was the same with the white men who were told that Asians score slightly better than whites on a test they were about to take. In both cases, when the students were primed to unconsciously believe they wouldn't score as well, they in fact didn't, even though what they were told was totally false. With this in mind, take a look at this list of some common limiting beliefs, and see which ones you may be harboring without being fully aware that you're doing so. I'm not good at math. I'm shy. I'm short-tempered. I'm not smart or creative. I'm a lot like my parents. Men shouldn't cry or be vulnerable. I can't find a partner. Women are lesser than men. My race or culture is superior. Life is serious. Life is difficult, and no one cares. I'm never going to be a success. I have to work hard to make it in life. Nothing good ever happens to me. I'm not a lucky person. Things never go my way. I never have enough time. It's someone else's responsibility to make me happy. When I own this particular thing, then I'll be happy. It's hard to change reality. Reality is a linear process. Germs make me sick. I gain weight easily. I need 8 hours of sleep. My pain is normal, and it'll never go away. My biological clock is ticking. Beauty looks like this. Having fun is frivolous. God is outside of me. I'm a bad person, so God doesn't love me. I could go on forever, but you get the idea. Since beliefs and perceptions are based on past experiences, then any of these beliefs that you happen to hold about yourself came from your past. So are they true, or did you just make them up? Even if they were true at some point in time, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're true now. We don't look at it that way, of course, because we're addicted to our beliefs. We're addicted to the emotions of our past. We see our beliefs as truths, not ideas that we can change. If we have very strong beliefs about something, evidence to the contrary could be sitting right in front of us, but we may not see it because what we perceive is entirely different. We've in fact conditioned ourselves to believe all sorts of things that aren't necessarily true. And many of these things are having a negative impact on our health and happiness. Certain cultural beliefs are a good example. Remember the story about the voodoo curse from Chapter 1. The patient was convinced he was going to die because the voodoo priest had put a hex on him. The hex only worked because he, and others in his culture, believed voodoo to be true. It wasn't the voodoo that had hexed him. It was the belief in the voodoo. Other cultural beliefs can cause premature deaths. For instance, Chinese Americans who have a disease, combined with a birth year that Chinese astrology and Chinese medicine consider to be ill-fated, die up to 5 years early, according to researchers at the University of California at San Diego, who studied the death records of almost 30,000 Chinese Americans. The effect was stronger in those who were more attached to Chinese traditions and beliefs, and the results also held consistent for nearly all major causes of death studied. For example, Chinese Americans born in years associated with susceptibility to diseases involving lumps and tumors died of lymphatic cancer 4 years younger than Chinese Americans born in other years, or than non-Chinese Americans with similar cancers. As these examples demonstrate, we're suggestible only to what we consciously or unconsciously believe to be true. An Eskimo who doesn't believe in Chinese astrology is no more suggestible to the idea that he's vulnerable to a certain disease because he was born in the year of the tiger or the year of the dragon than an Episcopalian would be suggestible to the idea that a hex from a voodoo priest could kill him or her. But once any of us accepts, believes, and surrenders to an outcome without consciously thinking about it or analyzing it, then we'll become suggestible to that particular reality. In most people, such a belief is planted well beyond the conscious mind into the subconscious system, which is what creates the disease. So now let me ask you another question. How many personal beliefs, based on cultural experiences, do you have that may not be true? Changing beliefs may be difficult, but it's not impossible. Just think what would happen if you were able to successfully challenge your unconscious beliefs. Instead of thinking and feeling, "I never have enough time to get everything done," what if you instead thought and felt, "I live in no time," and "I accomplish everything"? What if instead of believing, "The universe is conspiring against me," you believed, "The universe is friendly and works in my favor"? What a great belief. How would you think? How would you live? And how would you walk down the street if you believed the universe works in your favor? How do you think that would change your life? When you change a belief, you have to start by first accepting that it's possible, then change your level of energy with the heightened emotion you read about earlier, and finally, allow your biology to reorganize itself. It's not necessary to think about how that biological reorganization will happen or when it's going to happen. That's the analytical mind at work, which pulls you back into a beta brainwave state and makes you less suggestible. Instead, you just have to make a decision that has finality. And once the amplitude or energy of that decision becomes greater than the hardwired programs in your brain and the emotional addiction in your body, then you are greater than your past. Your body will respond to a new mind, and you can affect real change. You already know how to do this. Think about a time in your past when you made up your mind to change something about yourself or your life. If you recall, a moment came when you probably said to yourself, "I don't care how I feel, body. It doesn't matter what's going on in my life, environment, and I'm not concerned how long it will take, time. I'm going to do this." Instantly, you got goosebumps. That's because you moved into an altered state of being. The moment you felt that energy, you were sending your body new information. You felt inspired, and you came out of your familiar resting state. That's because by thought alone, your body moved from living in the same past to living in a new future. In reality, your body was no longer the mind. You were the mind. You were changing a belief. Like beliefs, our perceptions of past experiences, whether positive or negative, directly affect our subconscious state of being and our health. In 1984, Gretchen van Bommel, MD, then Associate Director of Clinical Electrophysiology at Doheny Eye Institute in Los Angeles, uncovered a striking example of this when she noticed a disturbing trend among Cambodian women referred to Doheny. The women, all between the ages of 40 and 60, and living in nearby Long Beach, California, known as Little Phnom Penh because of its roughly 50,000 Cambodian residents, were having severe vision problems, including blindness, in disproportionately high numbers. Physically, the women's eyes were perfectly healthy. Dr. Van Bommel did brain scans on the women to evaluate how well their visual systems were functioning and compared them to how well their eyes were seeing. She found that each of the women had perfectly normal visual acuity, often 20/20 or 20/40. Although, when they tried to read an eye chart, their vision tested at legally blind. Some of the women had absolutely no light perception and couldn't even detect any shadows, even though there wasn't anything physically wrong with their eyes. When Dr. Van Bommel teamed up with Patricia Rossi, PhD of California State University, Long Beach, to do research on the women, they found that those who had the worst vision had spent the most time living under the Khmer Rouge, or in refugee camps when communist dictator Pol Pot was in power. The genocide perpetrated by the Khmer Rouge was responsible for the deaths of at least 1.5 million Cambodians between 1975 and 1979. Of the women studied, 90% had lost family members, some as many as 10 during that time, and 70% were forced to watch their loved ones, sometimes even their entire families, being brutally murdered. "These women saw things that their minds just could not accept," Rosie told the Los Angeles Times. "Their minds simply closed down and they refused to see any more. Refused to see any more death, any more torture, any more rape, any more starvation." One woman was forced to watch her husband and four children be killed right in front of her, and she lost her sight immediately afterwards. Another woman had to watch a Khmer Rouge soldier beat her brother and his three children to death, which included seeing her three-month-old nephew being thrown against a tree until he died. She started losing her eyesight right after that. The women also suffered beatings, starvation, untold humiliations, sexual abuse, torture, and 20-hour days of enforced labor. Although they were now safe, many of these women told the researchers that they preferred to stay in their homes, where they had to relive their memories of the atrocities over and over through recurring nightmares and intrusive thoughts. Documenting a total of 150 cases of psychosomatic blindness in Cambodian women in Long Beach, the largest